Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. You're listening to Breech Babies 101 Part 3 with my guests, Dr. Barry Brock, Beth Cannon, Susan Minnick, and Dr. Milo Shavira.
So I saw a high-risk doctor last week to get my first ultrasound after my midwife felt that the baby was probably Breech. And I'm sorry, that was two Tuesdays ago, 34 weeks. And she started questioning me about my diet and my sugar intake. And I got tested for the third time for gestational diabetes, and it was negative. And I got really stressed out and paranoid. I also was told that the weight was perfect at the time. And 9 days later today, when I found out that the baby at that moment had its head down, I have no idea what position it's in right now. I was told that it weighs the same amount as it did
as nine days ago.
So, which makes me think of more fluid,
not
more space.
First time mothers, but I can tell you, there's multiple studies out, and second time mothers, not first time, between doctors, mothers, and ultrasound, by far the most accurate are mothers. Not first time, they're clueless, but second time mothers is a bigger small than the previous kid, and they're so much more accurate than all of us. So, I'm going to tell you, take with a big grain of salt when an ultrasound or someone tells you that. It's very difficult to predict the weight.
I would also like to jump in on this part as the ultrasound specialist in the room. You know, there's this incredible over-reliance and over-interpretation on the value of the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. Like, we have these measurements, like measuring the amniotic fluid. It's very inaccurate. You know, you made this comment that, you know, last week you were 21 and, you know, now this week you're 19. It's the same. The precision of the measurement is not that high. The correlation between this amniotic fluid index and actually how much fluid is in there is not that high. This is all really just kind of a rough, you know, estimate. So when I hear you tell me that the fluid was 21, what I hear in my mind is normal. It's normal. Yeah. End of story. Mm-hmm. There's no difference between, you know, it's 22 and 17 mm-hmm. and 9. This is all, it's just normal.
But my question, what I'm sort of getting at is low birth weight correlated with excessive fluid? Is there a relation?
Actually, the other way around. If you take populations of mothers who have excess amniotic fluid, one of the things that you'll commonly find is a big baby. Mm-hmm. So there is a relationship between, and it kind of makes sense, a bigger baby is going to make more water. But you don't always find that. The other thing that you very, very commonly find when you have excess amniotic fluid is you find nothing. You find a totally normal, healthy baby. Now, as the fluid starts to get more and more and more and more, then you do start to find, you know, some problems, you know, fetal anomalies and so forth. But even in these cases where we have, you know, milder degrees of excess fluid, most of the time what you got is a totally normal, you know, pregnancy. And in your case, this conversation is not even relevant because your fluid is just
normal range.
Yes. Just normal.
Again, above adequate.
I do tell my patients, your fluid's up, the fluid is, because it's very important to me, because when I deliver the baby, after the baby, I have to watch out because I can really
snorkel.
Get soaked.
You need a snorkel.
It just flies at it. All this fluid comes. Mm-hmm. Oh, fuzz. I remember now you had the extra fluid.
Sure.
And I had to watch it because the baby comes out and it all comes flying out. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest concern I have.
I've been noticing lately, actually, a lot of the OBs don't even offer the ECV anymore, which is what happened to Fabriola, who was just here. They just skip onto the cesarean. And I sort of feel like it's on its way out.
Well, hopefully not.
I hope not.
It's a great technique, and it can be, you know, even you, I, you know, I run 60%, but even 30%, 40%, it's still a great tech, especially if they don't do vaginal breech deliveries.
The only option
is their section.
Well,
rightly
I'm
so.
Glad you brought that up. Our last topic that we want to talk about today is, what if you've already done the chiropractic, the acupuncture, the massage, the pulsatile, the positional exercises, and you've rubbed marmalade in a counterclockwise position on your belly button, and you've done an ECV and none of it has worked? What are your options after that? I know commonly the only option is given schedules a cesarean at 39 weeks, but I feel like there's more options than that. What options do you offer?
In my mind, the three basic ideas are, one, Do what your doctor says, which is schedule the cesarean section, and that's the plan.
39 weeks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you could stretch it out another, you know, week or two and give a little more time to see if the baby spontaneously turns. But one option is basically go with the flow, with the, you know, modern obstetric flow, which is plan the cesarean delivery. Option number two is to try to make some efforts to turn the baby. So everything that we, you know, talked about today, and you know, try to increase the chance of getting the baby head down. And option number three is to plan for vaginal breech delivery.
Okay, so before we get to vaginal breech delivery, do you normally, if somebody wants to do a, if they're going to opt for the cesarean, do you prefer 39 weeks over waiting, or what are?
No, I give them the option. I says you can schedule any time after 39 weeks. You can schedule it, or you can wait to go into labor.
Is it the same if it's footling? Because you mentioned there's the issue.
Well,
of the
if it's footling breach, is a different story. Especially then, my concern is if it's dilated
and if the water breaks.
If she's not dilated, even the water breaks, not a big problem. Right. But if she's dilated, then in fact, you may even do something. That's one case. If she's failed diversion and she got a footling breach and she's like 3 centimeters dilated, that's the patient I mean, do before 39 weeks.
Sure.
So then she ruptures, you're in big trouble. But that's a rare case, thank God.
Okay.
So, you know.
Rare that it would be footling and dilating.
Right.
Okay. So as long as it's not footling breech, you're comfortable waiting beyond 39 weeks.
Yes.
Benefits being maybe the baby will still turn.
Well, the mother always likes the idea that something will happen. And it's
exactly.
possible.
It is possible. And then, but
you
also
said all these techniques you tried and failed, so it's less likely, but
no, other doctors who are not comfortable with vaginal breech birth sort of paranoid about beyond 39 weeks because if they go into labor, they don't have anything to do.
Well,
an emergency
C-section. I like spontaneous labors versus intervening. So I usually like to go into labor. So I'm doing a breech delivery. I like to go into spontaneous labor. I also don't do anything, and I don't care what's going on, until about 6-7 centimeters. But that's after I get the 6-7 centimeters, and she's in active labor, I want to see a gorgeously normal, perfect labor curve. I want to see the butt coming down. I want you dilating. And if it's not doing that stuff, this is not dragging it out for, oh, she's stuck at 8 centimeters for 6 hours. No, that's a sign that Mother Nature is telling me this is not the case for you. And if she starts pushing, I want to see this butt coming down nicely. And that's the criteria that I use to make sure a safe vaginal delivery.
Are there other criteria that you guys use beforehand that makes somebody more or less of a good candidate for a vaginal breech birth?
There's a rare occurrence of the stargazer. So in other words, theoretically, the baby has a big goiter or something, the head is extended up and looking up to the stars. They call it stargazer effect. And then, because the baby has to flex its head and neck to come out. If it can't do that, and something's blocking it, that can present a problem.
You tell that on ultrasound?
You can tell on ultrasound, but it's a rare event.
No, how do you know it's not just a snapshot? They're just extending at that
moment.
Well,
it's really
stuck into a deep extension.
Deep extension, the kid's neck's up, and you see usually some mass is holding it back. And I also want to make sure this child, you know, she's diabetic and the child's going to be 12 pounds. I mean, I'm not going to strive for vaginal.
Usually, I think throughout the world, they're saying 4,000 grams. Roughly
about 9 pounds,
under 4,000 grams, maybe 4,500,
well,
depending on.
I like the height of the mother. Mm-hmm. If someone's tall, it makes me feel so much nicer because the pelvis is a bit, it goes by size. And the taller you are, that gives, you know, someone's 4'6" and, you know, from Guatemala, but it's her first kid, I'm not too thrilled to.
Height of the mother because it's easier for birth, or you're saying some of that weight is height, not girth?
Well, because the pelvis is, usually I find the pelvis are bigger and taller women, Mother Nature makes it
more space.
More room.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have a similar criteria, Dr. Shavir?
You know, these one size fits all criteria just drive me absolutely bonkers and, you know, contributes to just a very mindless practice style. So I think, you know, taking into account their obstetric history and their body size and what we think of the baby and doing more of an individualized approach.
What are we worried about with a breech baby outside of umbilical cord prolapse, which we can rule out?
Let me tell you, you need some good cojones liver vaginal breech delivery because everything's fine.
Beth
until
does it.
No, but well,
yeah, Beth used to do.
I do.
She's got it. She got good cojones because let me tell you, after it comes down, you do not want to get this head stuck. because then, because a cord's beside that, you need to get this baby out. And you want from the umbilicus to the baby out, you want a reasonable amount of time. And these babies come out, and Mother Nature has a system, they come out and they are a little depressed. They're not screaming immediately, but they perk up in a couple of minutes, it's fine. But if your baby gets trapped there, that's a problem, you know, and I...
What's the problem?
Well, if the head doesn't come out, normally, if the head's coming down, the head can squeeze and mold and the bones, all those things, and it takes time. The same thing happened with beach delivery, but while it's doing it, the baby's dying because the cord's trapped. So you don't have that luxury of waiting to the head mold and squeeze itself out of there. You have to have a quick and efficient delivery. So that's why I use all these criteria of everything progressing very nicely. Now, you can, and I've had one time that the cervix went ahead and came down and was clamped down. And you have to, I like the experience, you use Piper forceps, or forceps designed to get the baby around the baby and to pop it out. There's techniques I use, the lifting the baby up, and there's different techniques. You put your finger in the baby's mouth and rotate it. And 98% of the time, that's what happens.
Do you use those techniques when you do a breech cesarean? Not the Piper, but I'm saying like the, to get the, I mean, is it different to deliver?
Yeah, but remember, if it's easy. I can always extend the incision, incision. That's easy. I can't do that in the pelvis.
Do you end up cutting? Well, I mean, you could do a episiotomy to give you a little more space.
But that's not the episiotomy.
It's more of the cervix.
It's the cervix, and it's the bones, the shape of the bones that do that. You don't have much room to do those things. So you have to have the experience to do that, and have the forceps available to do those things. I also use the criteria for beach deliveries, which I like in patients. I like the comfortable because I have to manipulate sometimes. And most of my patients, I prefer them to have an epidural. I don't insist upon it, but I prefer them to have an epidural so I can control them. Now, if they don't want to be activated, I can just have them positioned. So if I'm coming down and I need to do something, I can manipulate and move around. Because you have to have the mother helping you out. She has to have, you know, legs extended, you need some room. You can't have her jumping off the table because you're controlling. You don't have time. You don't have the luxury to do all these things because so it takes a lot of.
So for you, as long as labor starts relatively spontaneously and progresses at a normal.
Once she gets, you go slowly till she gets to active phase. But once she gets to active phase of labor, it means 6 centimeters dilated, 6 to 7. And then I want to see the dilate go rapidly and the butt start coming down in a very good pattern. I did one patient, did exactly that. Everything perfect. She failed version, everything else. And then she started pushing. After 2 hours of pushing, this butt did not come from zero station. And I sectioned her for a 9.5-pound baby.
Do you feel like there's a benefit to labor before doing a cesarean? Or is that a downside?
Well,
is it like double jeopardy? Oh, no, I had labor and now I still have to have a cesarean?
Laboring before the cesarean section, it does thin out the lower end segment. It makes the repair, I think, more secure. But it also increases your chance of infection. There is some evidence now coming out to do a vaginal prep. In other words, put betadine in the vagina when you do a cesarean section, someone's in labor. Okay. But, you know, the infection rate, when I was a resident and I rotated through a county hospital, every one of my cesarean section got infected, every single one of them. And then when I operated Cedars, my infection rate is extremely small, you know. So also, cesarean section counting when I was a resident was like took 2 hours, and mine now takes 25, 30 minutes. So there's a big difference, too.
So this is a great question you ask about the pre-labor cesarean versus a cesarean done that's after labor has started. And one of the problems with the obstetric literature is that historically these two cases were not divided. It was just vaginal delivery versus cesarean section. Mm-hmm. So we were not really scientifically able to kind of address this question. But I think there's a growing appreciation for the fact that there are a lot of physiologic processes that happen both in the baby and the mother in the labor process that are designed to help the baby transition from the in utero life to the, you know, out in the world life, and also begin the breastfeeding process, and it happens, you know, together with and during the labor process. So there now actually is some literature showing that the babies do better when you actually wait for the labor to start and then doing the cesarean compared to the ones you just do a cesarean and there's no sign of labor anywhere on the horizon. And I think we're going to start to see, you know, more and more studies looking at that, but there actually may very well be some physiologic reasons why the ideal thing to do is wait till labor starts, and you don't necessarily wait till they're
deep inside labor.
You know, 9 centimeters, ready 10 centimeters, you know, the baby's halfway out, but you kind of wait for the labor process to start and then do the cesarean at that time. So I think we're going to start hearing a lot more
about
this.
So that could be another benefit of not scheduling at 39 weeks, even if you're planning to have a cesarean.
Yeah.
But waiting until you go into labor. I think also one thing that we maybe didn't mention was, in terms of who's a better candidate and worse candidate, is somebody who's already had a successful vaginal birth. Even just a vaginal head down baby, this is their second or third baby, and they've already had one or two vaginal births.
The more vaginal deliveries have, this, I feel much more comfortable. It's much more easier. Everything goes much quicker.
And the odds of the head entrapment.
The reason why the literature doesn't back that up is because doctors used to think that, because she had a previous vaginal delivery, this one should make it. So they didn't look at the obvious, this one's not progressing, you know, things like that. So, you know, all of a sudden they're trying to drag out a 10-pound kid vaginally, breech, because she thought just to go like the other, she delivered two babies before. Not necessarily, you have to...
But if she's had two 7-pound babies, now she has another roughly 7-pound baby.
Absolutely, no question.
But they're treated by medicine generally like the same as anybody else who's breech, schedule you for a cesarean at 39
weeks.
Well,
they do, but those... And listen, I've seen... They're rushing back to patient for cesarean section. Why? She's brute. Why? The butt's on the perineum.
Exactly.
Oh, my
just
God.
Just let it come out.
Jesus,
do you
let
help
it fall
them? That, if you see that, do you help with doing a vaginal?
I've been called back to help, but I don't. I'm not my patient. I can't. I know. I can't intervene.
But it's so upsetting
to see
that.
That's not protocol. I can't. I know. Your doctor's taking back for cesarean section. Well, stop. I can do this vaginally. You know, you can't do that.
I think another thing that we didn't address is twins, because you brought it up briefly, or you did.
It's so sad.
If you have two babies and baby A, the first baby to come out is vertex, head down, and then the second baby is roughly the same size or smaller and breech. A lot more doctors are comfortable delivering those twins vaginally, and even if the second baby stays breech.
They should be, but a lot are not, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, I shouldn't say a lot. A handful more are comfortable with that after coming twin.
Yeah. A few.
That's breech.
A few. There's a few of them.
But why do you say they should be more comfortable with it? Why is that not a concern like a regular breech baby, a singleton?
Well, first of all, remember, someone's already dilated everything open. It's there. So usually the head doesn't get trapped. It comes out as long as the second baby, and usually second babies usually are smaller, but they can be exception. You know, I had one patient that the ultrasonographers told me that the baby was a pound bigger. And I delivered the first one, and so this one I personally did not do a breech extraction. And after 6 hours, I gave up and sectioned for the second one. Yeah, it was a pound bigger, but the head was, I tried to bring the head down, it wasn't coming. It
wasn't coming.
You know, but that's a patient. Normally, if I didn't know it was a pound bigger, I would have put it up and done a breech extraction. But
so safer, because if baby A comes out and baby B is roughly the same size or smaller, then it should just come out. The odds of getting trapped very small. What about the concern about the cord?
Well, first of all, you don't draw your cord bloods, but usually you go ahead and the cord should not be a problem. But over the years, I've had to do cesarean section for the second twin, but fortunately, it's not that common appearance, and maybe once or twice in my career, but it does happen. You're set up for that.
Have you?
I do my vaginal, my twin deliveries in a quota C-section room, but I do everything vaginally.
All of you, because you have experience with clients who have breech babies, do you have patients who have had both vaginal breech birth and vaginal head down birth? Because one of the most common questions when somebody's considering this is, that must be incredibly painful to deliver a vaginal breech birth. Do you have a comparison from patients who've done both about one being a lot more uncomfortable or difficult?
I've heard that it's just different. It's different. It feels different than the head first baby.
So not
one of them said, and it was her 6th baby.
Oh.
Interesting. Right. And that baby, it was like that. It was. Like, I almost missed it because I was thinking about what would I do if whatever. But, you know, anyways, she just plopped out.
Right.
But mom afterward was like, of the 6, that was the most painful.
The breech.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a handful say that. Most say it's just different, not one's better or worse. And a handful say that the breech was more comfortable with the soft butt pushing down there the whole labor. We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I understand the mental demands of motherhood. I see it every day in my practice. That's why I'm excited about Needed's new cognitive support. Unlike other supplements, it's specifically formulated with postpartum and breastfeeding moms in mind, using safe and effective ingredients. This means that moms can get the brain boost they deserve without compromising safety. Plus, it includes clinically studied ingredients, proven to support focus and memory. Hurry and get your cognitive support from Needed before you forget. Visit thisisneeded.com and use your code Berlin to get 20% off your initial order. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash. You have a final question?
Yeah, maybe two short, quick ones. One, are most vaginal breech births done on the back? Or are there different positions that can be done delivering a vaginal breech baby? And then my second question is, if it was done with the cesarean section, what exactly happens? How do you deliver the placenta then? Is there delayed cord clamping? Is it vaginal? Or is it pulled? You know, what happens?
If you use a cesarean section, you deliver the baby, you can milk the cord or delay cord clamping and give the blood to the baby. And then placenta comes out. That's the easiest thing in the world because it's right there. You can manually take it out of the uterus. Remember, you had a cesarean section.
mm-hmm.
And the first question was,
do you deliver
vaginal breech babies?
I always have to be on the back.
I
do my deliveries all the same way. Usually I do some on the side, things like this, but I usually like more control. I have a sitting up position I like to deliver at, like gravity helped me, but that's me. But other different positions you can, but you do need
access.
Wait, Dr. Shavir, if you deliver breech, is it different on the back for you versus a head down baby?
Well, I think probably most obstetricians are trained with the patient on the back, and there are, you know, techniques for delivering in that position. But it's maybe that the best way to do it is on hands and knees. I don't know how you.
I was just going to say that there's a most OBs are trained because they were trained a while ago to do on the back, but there's a lot in Europe and in Australia. There's a lot of upright and hands and knees. Mm-hmm.
Even for
delivery.
Breech.
So now, okay. And I've done upright and hands and knees as well.
Because from what I understand, if you're hooked up or you have an epidural or you're hooked up,
well,
you can't. You have to be on
that's
your
the
back.
Thing. Well,
right? Then I heard the midwife
even Dr. Brock said he doesn't always have an epidural.
Oh, okay.
It's maybe his preference, but he leaves it up to you.
But you might not be.
You might not have any drugs in there either.
Dr. Shavir and I had a beautiful delivery of breech. The patient's not flat on her back, but she was sitting up.
Upright.
She was upright with her feet on the foot pedals, but she had an epidural, but she was sitting up. She wasn't flat on her back. So she was up and pushing this way, and it was a beautiful birth.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is that I just find this so universal in medicine, these things that get said that are just untrue. You know, you hear this, if you have an epidural, then you can't move.
Oh.
I think what happens is, that on labor and delivery, what they like to do is they put the epidural, they lay in the bed, they put a Foley catheter into the bladder so that now we don't have to worry about, you know, when you have to pee. And then you just don't require any attention. You just lay there. And, but, you know, in fact, I don't know if you've ever heard this term, the walk-in epidural. But, you know, I've had patients that, you know, with an epidural and they're kind of laying there and they're uncomfortable and it, can I just get up And people are freaking out saying, how could she get up? There's no epidural. And we just get them up. So you can actually move when you have an epidural. And,
yes,
you know, it depends a little bit. Sometimes the block is very dense.
It also depends on the hospital policy. I know legal teams don't love when your legs are sort of wonky and jello-y you're in labor, for you to not have full control and be able to walk around, even if it's doable. Although with a walking, I mean, some hospitals have a protocol.
But you assist.
You assist, but I'm just saying you don't say, the lawyer doesn't care that you're assisting.
Yeah, feel free. Go ahead and get up. And then you assist. You help them out. You're there to kind of protect them.
But then I've also heard that you can't eat or drink.
While you're in labor?
With epidurals?
Uh-huh.
No, well, it depends. That's anesthesia.
Like some hospitals won't let you eat or drink.
Most hospitals have that. That's a matter of policy.
I give clear liquids, and I've had many arguments with anesthesia, but the anesthesia department now is comfortable with us having clear liquids. I make tea for all my patients. I give them clear liquids. They don't give you a lot of food to eat. But
if you have the epidural.
If you have an epidural, okay. Yeah.
Even in general, they don't let you.
Once you're in labor, some of the hospitals don't let you eat at all. Just ice chips. Can I please have some ice chips? Can I have an opaque fluid?
Okay.
I deliver a lot of, all my patients are delivered on the side or on hands and knees with epidurals. I do that all the time. And I teach the residents how to do that. And
you don't have to be flat on your back just because you have an epidural.
Okay. So breech, you can still be in different positions.
Yes.
Okay.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
All right. Did anybody have a final thought that you want to share on the topic of breech babies?
My final comment is, can we figure out a way to train the doctors?
Is there a way to reteach it on a grand scale in the country?
Because I know it's been brought up a volume and this and that. Yeah. Okay. So some location in America or some kind of funding or grant to get doctors and midwives, but doctors, because most people see doctors trained in the skill. Like, it doesn't make any logical sense to me. So
our children are definitely going to say, how did you let this happen? How did you let this skill disappear completely? Because that's where it's headed.
I agree with you. It's a major problem. Yeah. And
there's no one left.
My sense, I'll tell you what I think my sense. You asked, are we going to be able to reteach this on a grand scale? And if you mean by grand scale that it becomes part of the skill set of your standard obstetrician, I don't know that we'll ever, get there again. But the practice of medicine is becoming increasingly specialized, where you don't necessarily teach every physician how to do everything. Therapy. You know, the surgeons don't do every surgeon that's out there, but they kind of specialize. So I think a place we may be able to get to is where, every major city has a handful of physicians and midwives who are able to offer this, so that the practice is not completely dead and it becomes coordinated. Everybody in the city knows these are our breech providers. And when I have a breech patient, I can counsel them appropriately instead of telling them this is too dangerous. It's not an option. We're just scheduling your C-section. You can actually outline what the options are. And if you're interested in this one, with breech vaginal delivery, there's a place where we can send you. There are people who are experts in that. Hopefully we can get to that place. And I think we're going to have to grab an opportunity that we have right now, which is that we have an older generation of providers who have the knowledge and the skill. And we're going to have younger providers who have not yet been completely paralyzed by the medical legal fear and actually still have the interest in learning and serving the patient, and basically grab that knowledge and skills so we can keep it alive.
I had this secret dream that Kaiser Permanente, because you have so many hospitals in Southern California. But I will say this, Kaiser invited us to show the film Heads Up, to a whole room full of OBs and residents, and it was very well received. I wasn't sure, you know, when I show it to the midwives and doulas, it's a lot of hugs and kisses. I thought in the OB community, I thought I was going to get like Rotten Tomatoes, and it was very well received.
I know, it was.
And some of the younger doctors and residents in particular were very, you know, curious, and one of them, I think, went to Germany.
He's going. He didn't go.
He's going to Germany to get some training in breech.
Yes, he's interested. Mm-hmm.
So I just had this little, dream. Like you have so many patients and a high volume of breech clients that if one Kaiser could be set as the breech center, you know, in Southern California that had 24-hour breech coverage, and anybody who wanted to have a vaginal breech delivery would go to that one, it could become not only a place where people can go, but a place where people could train.
It doesn't seem like it should be that hard to do that, but it also seems like the hugest uphill battle.
Well, it's a big corporation.
And also, there's nobody left. As Dr. Monroe said to me, and I'm going to quote him, he said to me the other day, there's not enough institutional memory. Everybody is gone. And the two generations, there's no one left.
But there is.
But there are
and
people
that's the thing. There's a few.
There's a handful. But if and we even took in, that little ember. In
well, he's like, willing to help.
Yeah.
He is interested in that. When I came to Kaiser, we had a breech team.
But it has to come from
a
corporate level. I mean, right now, if you happen to have the baby while he's there, you know, then you can have a vaginal
birth.
We
need the patients. The consumers.
We had the opposite, right?
The consumers have to. I'm sorry, Elliot. Go ahead.
We had the opposite, where a patient was scheduled to have a cesarean, and she was, I think she worked at Kaiser, right? A nurse, an
anesthetist.
That's
who Milo and I delivered.
Yeah,
that's our
patient. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it was the opposite. Yes. She was all, tried everything, nothing worked. Baby was stuck breech, scheduled her cesarean, like a good little patient, and
but guess what happened?
She went into labor early. And then like you like ran into her in the hall or something. What happened?
I did acupuncture on her the night before. And this was like a blessing, because when Milo and I came to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, no patients came to labor and delivery. We had no patients. She came in, she kept dilating. And it was like, oh, can't we do a vaginal delivery? Can't we do a vaginal delivery? And Milo was so good with her. And she said, I really want to have this birth, but it wasn't happening because we didn't have the supervision. Anyway, she dilated. She got her epidural. We were all set to do the cesarean. I found Dr. Monroe. He came up, Dr. Monroe, Milo, and the resident. And I didn't do the delivery, but I was there as support. It was like nobody was there. We had the best nursing team. They let us deliver in the birthing suite. 5 o'clock, when we were all finished, all the patients came back into labor. It was like everybody.
Wow, they cleared out
I called you. I called Stu. I was like jumping for joy. It was like a miracle.
Yeah, the stars really aligned.
Yes, they did.
But they happened to align. But if there was always supervision there,
yes,
and there were young, you know, eager doctors who wanted to keep the choice alive.
Well, we have though. We have that.
I'll tell you, I was at this Kaiser with Susan for 5 years, so I, you know, I know that location fairly well, and I had this idea, and we had some discussions within the department about developing a breech team to, you know, increase the number of experienced attendings who, you know, were willing to do this, and the motivation was just a little low.
I think it's a case of you can't teach a new dog old tricks. Think about that for a second.
I told one of the doctors today I was coming here, and I was very proud today at our staff meeting that what you're doing and inviting me to come. I was proud of that. Well, of course, everyone thought it was ridiculous. And one of the new staff, who has a high C-section rate, just was like, well, why would you want to have a vaginal breech? Why would a doctor even want to? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be sued. I'm going to be sued. And it was like, and I said to him, you're practicing fear-based medicine again. This is what you and I discuss every time we're on labor and delivery together. Fear-based medicine never works. Of course, you're going to have complications. Of course, you're going to have problems because that's your role model for yourself. Something's going to happen.
And we did talk about some of the risks of the vaginal breech birth, but we didn't talk about any of the risks of the cesarean birth.
Well, Dr. Chavira, Milo and I have talked about this, and Milo has always said,
and that's just in that birth, and then she'll get pregnant again, and the next pregnancy automatically has some risk involved. So I also do want to stress that. That's a really good point, Susan, which is that I don't think anybody at this table is anti-cesarean.
No, we are not.
I think we're all in love with a cesarean that is given to somebody, offered to somebody who needs one.
Yes, and appropriate.
For sure, we're all in agreement on that. Mm-hmm. And probably most of us are in agreement for someone who really wants one, who's making an informed choice to have one, should also be supported in that choice, I think. Personally, maybe I'm not totally supported in that. I want you to listen to a conversation like this and come away with some facts that mm-hmm. are hard to come by. Mostly, if you find out your breech, you're going to be offered, just like fibrilla, a cesarean at 39 weeks, period. If you ask about an external version, you're going to be told about all the risks that could happen, and they're going to be blown out of proportion, made to seem like they happen pretty much every time we do one, or 50% chance of the benefits are minimized, the risks are maximized, and you walk away saying, I'm not going to do that. What I'd like you to do is, and same thing with vaginal birth versus cesarean birth, I don't have a choice for you, except that you have the information that you can make an informed choice and be supported in that choice. First step is to be able to make the choice. And what we're collectively working on is trying to create support system for that choice within the system. Yeah.
And that was one thing I wanted to mention as a patient when I'm frantically online researching, what is it that I can do? One thing that came up was a hospital in Oregon, and it actually crossed my mind. Maybe I need to go over there and stay a few weeks and deliver there.
You would not be the first.
So it would be great if there was some kind of centralized hospital or a network of hospitals that could cater to people like that, because it crossed my mind. I'm like, efforts, I'm packing up and moving.
Efforts are being put into that. The film was also meant to raise awareness, to let women know mm-hmm. you might have a choice here other than that scheduled cesarean at 39 weeks, or multiple choices, and to create more of a demand among people who want that choice, to go demand it from there. And it is happening. Our patients are the reason I call Dr. Brock every day, or Milo pretty much every day. Last week I put you in touch with somebody who was breech, or Dr. thanks, or Dr. Fishbein, or Dr. Wu, the handful left here who do it. As people are leaving their OB and going to someone who specializes in breech because they need that specialty, other OBs are sort of starting to say, maybe I need to think about this. I don't think it's created dramatic action, but there are a handful of sprouts.
Yes, absolutely.
That are talking about it, thinking about it, looking for training in it. And even Dr. Brock, who's doing a lot more of them now than he was doing before. So I think the other doctors are thinking about it, and we're trying.
It'd be good to have that support, because like for me, I have the mindset, if my body can make it, it can take it. And why can't I have that support?
Write a letter to ACOG. Yeah. That's a great idea.
It's a great idea. Look, ACOG got together in 2010.
And to your hospitals. I mean, it's going to be consumer-driven because,
it's consumer-driven.
National Institute of Health did get together in 2010, not about this, but about VBAC, which was also, it still is very hard to come by in many areas, and just did an analytical look at the state of VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, and their conclusion was there more people should be offered VBAC, and there's too many obstacles to getting one. And so I think if people do write to ACOG or the National Institute of Health and demand an analysis of breech, now that since 2006, ACOG sort of reversed their policy in Canada, where this all started, made a bigger reversal on their policy, and they offer more breech and they offer training among older doctors to younger doctors. Maybe it can happen. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be happening in the next 3 weeks.
No.
So you have to pursue what options
no,
you
but
have.
I appreciate, thank you so much. I appreciate all the information. Pleasure. And I'll definitely go and see you tomorrow.
All right. Okay. Oh, I'm going to come see you tomorrow then. I would like to thank,
thank you so
everybody
much
for being here. Dr. Barry Brock, Beth Cannon, Susan Minnick, and Dr. Mila Shavira, and our guests, Fabiola, Danielle, and Nusha. All I can say on the way out is if you look at our website, informedpregnancy.com, you'll find a lot more information about breech babies. You'll find a directory of doctors and midwives around the country who offer vaginal breech option and also other options in terms of trying to encourage your baby into the ideal position. And as always, I encourage you to research the options, weigh the pros and cons as they pertain to you specifically, make an informed choice, and try to find support for those choices. Thanks for listening to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. Find us at informedpregnancy.com, and as always, write questions to info@informedpregnancy.com. That concludes our series on Breech Babies 101. Hopefully you've picked up a tremendous amount of information and are in a better position to do more research, have conversations, and make informed choices. You can find our show notes and other information important for Breech at informedpregnancy.com. And as always, if you have any questions, feel free to write to info@informedpregnancy.com. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.